Chapter 2. Mouth Breathing. It's 8:15 a.m., and Olsen bursts in, Kramer-style, through the side door. "Good morning," he shouts. He has little balls of silicone lodged up his nose and is wearing cut-off sweatpants and an Abercrombie and Fitch sweatshirt. Olsen rented a studio across the street from me for a month, close enough to sneak over wearing his pajamas, but not close enough to avoid looking like a freak doing it. His face, once tan and bright, is now gaunt and sallow. He looks like Gary Busey in that mugshot from years past. He has the same spaced-out expression he had yesterday, the same haunted grin he wore the day before and the day before that. Today marks the halfway point of the mouth-breathing phase of the experiment, and today, like every other day, as he's been doing for three times a day, morning, noon, and night, Olsen takes a seat across from me. 1, 2, 3, we flip on a pile of beeping and burping machines lumped on the table, strap cuffs to our arms, place sensors to our ears, stick thermometers in our mouths, and begin recording our physiological data on spreadsheets. The readouts reveal what the previous days have revealed. Mouth breathing is destroying our health. My blood pressure has spiked by an average of 13 points from where it was before the test, which puts me deep into stage 1 hypertension. If left unchecked, the state of chronically raised blood pressure, also shared by a third of the U.S. population, can cause heart attacks, stroke, and other serious problems. Meanwhile, my heart rate variability, a measure of nervous system balance, has plummeted, suggesting that my body is in a state of stress. Then there's my pulse, which has increased, my body temperature, which has decreased, and my mental clarity, which has hit rock bottom. Olsen's data mirrors mine. But the worst part about all of this is how we feel. Awful. Every day, it all seems to be getting worse. And every day, at this exact time, Olsen finishes his last test, removes the respirator mask from his cotton-white hair. He stands up and jams the silicone plugs a little deeper into his nostrils. He puts on his sweatshirt, then walks out the door. I nod and watch as he trots his slippered feet through the hallways and back across the street. The final testing protocol, eating, happens alone. Through both phases of the experiment, we'll be consuming the same food at the same time while taking the same amount of steps throughout the day to see how mouth breathing and nasal breathing might affect weight and metabolism. Today, it's 3 eggs, half an avocado, a piece of German brown bread, and a pot of Lapsang tea. Which means that 10 days from now, I will again be sitting here in this kitchen eating the same meal. Scarf down breakfast, I do the dishes, I clean up some old filters on the dining room table, and then answer some emails. On some days, Olsen and I sit around and experiment with more comfortable and effective ways to keep our noses blocked. Waterproof earplugs, which were too hard, foam earplugs, which were too soft, a swimmer's nose clip, which was too painful, a CPAP nose pillow, comfortable but it looks like a bondage device, toilet paper, which was way too airy, chewing gum, which was too slimy, and finally, surgical tape over earplugs, which is chafing and stifling, but the least atrocious of the options. But most of the time, all day, every day, for the past several days, Olsen and I just sit around alone in our apartments and hate life. I often feel as though I'm trapped in some sad sitcom in which nobody laughs, a groundhog day of perpetual and unending misery. Luckily, today is a little different. Today, Olsen and I are going on a bike ride. Not on a beach boardwalk or in the shadow of the Golden Gate, but inside the concrete walls of a neighborhood gym. The cycling was Olsen's idea. He'd spent years researching the differences in performance between nasal breathers and mouth breathers during intense exercise. He'd conducted his own studies on CrossFit athletes, and he'd worked with coaches. He'd become convinced that mouth breathing can put the body into a state of stress that can make us more quickly fatigued and sap athletic performance. He insisted that for a few days during each phase of the experiment, we saddle up on a stationary bike at the neighborhood gym and pedal to the edge of our aerobic capacity. I put on some shorts, grab the fitness tracker, a water bottle, and exit through the backyard. Waiting by the fence is Antonio, a contractor and longtime friend who has been doing renovation work on the upper floor of my house. He looks over, and before I can beeline to the garden exit, he notices the pink earplugs in my nose. He drops an armful of 2x4s and comes over to take a closer look. I'd known Antonio for about 15 years, and he'd heard about all the oddball stories I've written in far-off places. He'd always been interested and supportive. That ended when I tell him what I've been up to this week. "This is a bad idea," he says. "In school, when I was young, teachers walked around the classroom, man, and pop, pop, pop." He smacks the back of his head for emphasis here. "You're breathing from your mouth, you get a pop." Mouth breathing leads to sickness and is disrespectful, he told me, which is why he and everyone else he grew up with in Puebla, Mexico, learned to breathe from the nose. Antonio told me his partner, Janet, suffers from chronic obstruction and runny nose. Janet's son, Anthony, is also a chronic mouth breather. He started to suffer the same problems. "I keep telling them this is bad. They try to fix it," Antonio said. "But it's hard, man." I'd heard a similar story from a British man named David a few years ago when Olsen and I were attempting our first nasal obstructed jog. He stopped us and asked what we were doing. Then he told us he'd had obstruction issues his whole life. He'd spent the last 20 years squirting various drugs up his nostrils, but they became less effective over time. Now he'd developed chronic respiratory problems. To avoid hearing any more of these stories and to evade any more unwanted attention, I'd learned to go outside only when I had to. Don't get me wrong, San Franciscans love weirdos. There was once a guy who used to walk down Haight Street with a hole in the back of his jeans so that his tail, an actual human tail about 5 inches long, could swing freely behind him. He hardly got second glances. But the sight of Olsen and me with plugs and tape and whatever else in and around our noses has proven too much for the locals to bear. Everywhere we go, we get either questioned or someone's long life story of breathing woes. How he had allergies his whole life. How she was sleeping worse and worse. How hard it was to just get a breath. I wave goodbye to Antonio and then jog a few blocks to the gym. I make my way around women speed-walking on treadmills and old men on weight machines. I can't help but notice all of them are mouth-breathing. Then I boot up the pulse oximeter, hop on a stationary bike, latch my feet to the pedals, and I'm off. The bike experiment is a repeat of several studies conducted 20 years earlier by Dr. John Duyar, a trainer of elite athletes from tennis star Billie Jean King to the New Jersey Nets. In the 1990s, Duyar became convinced that mouth breathing was hurting his clients. To prove it, he gathered a group of professional cyclists, rigged them up with sensors to record their heart rate and breathing rates, and put them on stationary bikes. Over several minutes, Duyar increased the resistance on the pedal, requiring the athletes to exert progressively more energy as the experiment went on. During the first trial, Duyar told the athletes to breathe entirely through their mouths. As the intensity increased, so did the rate of their breathing, which was expected. By the time athletes reached the hardest stage of the test, pedaling out 200 watts of power, they were panting and struggling to catch a breath. Then Duyar repeated the test while the athletes breathed entirely through their noses. As the intensity of exercise increased during this phase, the rate of breathing decreased. At the final 200-watt stage, one subject, who had been mouth breathing at a rate of 47 breaths per minute, was nasal breathing just 14 breaths. He maintained the same heart rate at which he'd started the test, even though the intensity of the exercise had increased tenfold. "Simply training yourself to breathe through your nose," Duyar reported, "could cut total exertion in half and offer huge gains in endurance." The athletes felt invigorated while nasal breathing rather than exhausted. They all swore off breathing through their mouths ever again. Back at the gym, I'll follow Duyard's test protocol for the next 30 minutes, but instead of measuring exertion with weight, I'll use distance. I'll keep my heart rate locked in at a consistent 130 beats per minute while measuring how far I can go with my nose plugged and breathing only from my mouth. Olson and I will come back here next week and do these same tests while breathing only through our noses. The data will provide a general overview of how mouth and nasal breathing affect athletic performance. To understand how this all works, we first need to understand how the body makes energy from air and food. There are two options: with oxygen, a process known as aerobic respiration, and without it, called anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic energy is generated only with glucose, and it's quicker and easier for our bodies to access. It's a kind of backup system and turbo boost when the body doesn't have enough oxygen. But anaerobic energy is inefficient and can be toxic, creating an excess of lactic acid. That nausea, muscle weakness, and sweating you experience after you've pushed it too hard at the gym is the feeling of anaerobic overload. Essentially, anaerobic energy is like a muscle car. It's fast and responsive for quick trips, but polluting and impractical for long hauls. This is why aerobic respiration is so important. Remember those cells that evolved to eat oxygen 2.5 billion years ago and kicked off that explosion of life? We've got some 37 trillion of them in our bodies. When we run our cells aerobically with oxygen, we gain some 16 times more energy efficiency over anaerobic. The key for exercise and for the rest of life is to stay in that energy-efficient, clean-burning, oxygen-eating aerobic zone for the majority of time during exercise and at all times during rest. Back in the gym, I pedal a little harder, breathe a little deeper, and watch as my heart rate steadily increases. Over the next 3 minutes of this warm-up, I'll need to get to 136, then keep it there for a half hour. This rate should be right at the aerobic-anaerobic threshold for a man my age. Finding the best heart rate for exercise is easy. Just subtract your age from 180. The result is the maximum your body can withstand to stay in the aerobic zone. Long bouts of training and exercise can happen below this rate, but never above it. Otherwise, the body will risk going too deep into the anaerobic zone for too long. Instead of feeling invigorated and strong after a workout, you'll feel tired, shaky, and nauseated, which is exactly what happens to me. After I do a half hour of vigorous pedaling and open mouth huffing, the clock on the stationary bike ticks down to zero and the whirling gears slow to a stop. I'm sweating profusely and feel bleary-eyed, but I've pedaled a total of only 6.4 miles. I scoot off the bike and let Olson take a spin, then it's back to the home lab for a shower, glass of water, and more testing. Decades before Olson and I jammed our noses shut, and before Dulyar put his cyclists through the rounds, scientists were running their own tests on the pros and cons of mouth breathing. There was Austin Young, an enterprising doctor in England, who in the 1960s treated a slew of chronic nosebleeders by sewing their nostrils shut. One of Young's followers, Valerie J. Lund, revived the process 40 years later and stitched the nostrils of dozens of patients. I tried to contact Lund to ask how her mouth-breathing patients fared after weeks, months, and years, but I never got a reply. Luckily, those consequences were spelled out by an orthodontist and researcher chasing very different ends. Egil Harvold's hideous experiments in the 1980s would not go over well with PETA or anyone else who has really cared for animals. Working from a lab in San Francisco, he gathered a troop of monkeys and stuffed silicone deep into the nasal cavities of half of them, leaving the other half as they were. The obstructed animals couldn't remove the plugs, and they couldn't breathe at all through their noses. They were forced to adapt to constant mouth breathing. Over the next 6 months, Harvold measured the animals' dental arches, the angles of their chins, the length of their faces, and more. The plugged-up monkeys developed the same downward growth pattern, the same narrowing of the dental arch and gaping mouth. Harvold repeated these experiments, keeping the animals obstructed for 2 years. They fared even worse. Along the way, he took a lot of pictures. The photographs are heart-wrenching, not only for the sake of the poor monkeys, but because they offer such a clear reflection of our own species. After just a few months, our faces too can grow long, slack-jawed, and glazed over. Mouth breathing, it turns out, changes the physical body and transforms airways, all for the worse. Inhaling air through the mouth decreases pressure, which causes the soft tissues at the back of the mouth to become loose and flex inward, creating less space and making breathing more difficult. Mouth breathing begets more mouth breathing. Inhaling from the nose has the opposite effect. It forces air against all those flabby tissues at the back of the throat, making the airways wider and breathing easier. After a while, these tissues and muscles get toned to stay in that open and wide position. Nasal breathing begets more nasal breathing. None of this should come as much of a surprise. When seasonal allergies hit, incidences of sleep apnea and breathing difficulties shoot up. The nose gets stuffed, we start mouth breathing, and the airways collapse. Sleeping exacerbates these problems, of course. Whenever we put our heads on a pillow, gravity pulls the soft tissues in the throat and tongue downward, closing off the airway even more. After a while, our airways get conditioned to this position. Snoring and sleep apnea become the new normal. I've made it to the final night of the nasal obstruction phase of the experiment, and I am, once again, sitting up in bed, staring out the window. When a Pacific breeze blows in, which it does most nights, the shadow of the trees and plants on the backyard wall across from my bedroom start to move and groove in a chromatic kaleidoscope. One moment they reorganize into a cadre of Edward Gorey gentlemen in waistcoats, the next into crooked Escher staircases. Another gust of wind, and these scenes disintegrate and reform into recognizable stuff, ferns, bamboo, and bougainvillea. This is a long way of saying, I can't sleep. My head's been propped up on pillows, and I've been taking notes on this creepy tableau for a half hour. I unconsciously try to sniff and clear my nose, but instead get a jolt of pain in my head. It's a sinus headache, and in my case, self-inflicted. Each night for the past week and a half, I felt as if I was getting softly choked to death in my sleep and my throat was closing in on itself. Because it is, because I am. Forced mouth breathing was very likely changing the shape of my airways, just as it did with Harvold's monkeys. The changes weren't happening in a matter of months either, but in days. It was getting worse with every breath I took. As of this evening, my snoring has increased 4,800% from 10 days ago. For the first time that I'm aware of, I'm beginning to suffer from obstructive sleep apnea. At my worst, I've averaged 25 apnea events, meaning I was choking so severely that my oxygen levels dropped to below 85%. Whenever oxygen gets this low, the blood can't carry enough of it to support body tissues. If this goes on too long, it can lead to heart failure, depression, memory problems, and more. My snoring and sleep apnea are still far below that of any medically diagnosed condition, but these scores were getting worse the longer I stayed plugged up. Every morning, Olsen and I would listen to the recordings of ourselves sleeping. At first, we laughed, but then we got a little frightened. What we heard weren't the sounds of happy Dickensian drunks, but the sounds of men being strangled to death by their own bodies. More wholesome to sleep with the mouth shut, wrote Levinus Lemnius, a Dutch physician from the 1500s, who was credited as one of the first researchers to study snoring. Even back then, Levinus knew how injurious obstructive breathing during sleep could be. For they that sleep with their jaws extended by reason of their breath, and the air tossed to and fro, have their tongues and palates dry, and desire to be moistened by drinking in the night. This was another thing that was happening to me. Mouth breathing causes the body to lose 40% more water. I felt this all night, every night, waking up constantly parched and dry. You'd think that this moisture loss would decrease the need to urinate, but oddly, the opposite was true. During the deepest, most restful stages of sleep, the pituitary gland, the pea-sized ball at the base of the brain, secretes hormones, including something called vasopressin, which is an antidiuretic. It communicates with cells to store more water. This is how animals can sleep through the night without feeling thirsty or needing to relieve themselves. But if the body has inadequate time in deep sleep, as it does when it experiences chronic sleep apnea, vasopressin won't be secreted normally. The kidneys will release water, which triggers the need to urinate, and also signals our brains that we should consume more liquid. We get thirsty, and yet we need to pee more. A lack of vasopressin explains not only my own irritable bladder, but the constant, seemingly unquenchable thirst I have every night. There are several books that describe the horrendous health effects of snoring and sleep apnea. They explain how these afflictions lead to bedwetting, diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, and on and on. I'd read a report from the Mayo Clinic which found that chronic insomnia, long assumed to be a psychological problem, is often a breathing problem. The millions of Americans who are right now, like me, staring out bedroom windows or at TVs or at phones or at ceilings can't sleep because they can't breathe. Mouth breathing was also making me dumber. A recent Japanese study showed that rats who had their nostrils obstructed and were forced to breathe through their mouths developed fewer brain cells and took twice as long to make their way through a maze than their nasal breathing controls. Another study in humans from 2013 found that mouth breathing delivered a disturbance of oxygen to the prefrontal cortex, the area of the brain associated with ADHD. Nasal breathing had no such effects. The ancient Chinese were onto this as well. The breath inhaled through the mouth is called ni qi, adverse breath, which is extremely harmful, states a passage from the Tao. Be careful not to have the breath inhaled through the mouth. As I lie in bed, tossing and turning, fighting the urge to run to the bathroom again, I'm trying to focus on the positive. I am reminded of a skull from Mariana Evans' collection that offered a much-needed dose of hope. It was morning, and Evans was seated in front of an oversized computer monitor in the office of her orthodontics practice, about a half an hour west of downtown Philadelphia. With white walls and white-tiled floors, the place looked futuristic. She brought up two images on a computer, one of an ancient skull from the Morton collection and the other of a young girl, a new patient. I'll call her Gigi. Gigi was about 7 in the photo. Her teeth jutted from the top of her gums, outward, inwards, and in all directions. There were dark circles under her eyes. Her lips were chapped and open as if she were sucking on an imaginary popsicle. She suffered from chronic snoring, sinusitis, and asthma. She just started developing allergies to foods, dust, and pets. Gigi grew up in a wealthy household. She followed the food pyramid, got plenty of outdoor exercise, had her immunizations, took vitamins D and C, had no illness growing up. And yet, here she was. I see patients like this all day, said Evans. They are all the same. And here we are. 90% of children have acquired some degree of deformity in their mouths and noses. 45% of adults snore occasionally, and a quarter of the population snores constantly. 25% of American adults over 30 choke on themselves because of sleep apnea. Meanwhile, the majority of the population suffers from some form of breathing difficulty or resistance. We found ways to clean up our cities, to tame or kill off many of the diseases that have destroyed our ancestors. We become more literate, taller, and stronger. On average, we live 3 times longer than people in the industrial age. And yet we've lost touch with our most basic and important biological function. But Evans hasn't invited me to see her research just to lament the present. Her obsession with tracing the decline of human breathing is just a starting point. She'd studied it for years entirely at her own expense because she wants to help. she and her colleague Kevin Boyd are using those hundreds of measurements they've taken from ancient skulls to build a new model of airway health for modern humans. They are part of a burgeoning group of pulmonauts exploring novel therapies in breathing, lung expansion, and orthodontics. Their goal is to help return Gigi, me, and everyone else to our more perfect ancient forms, the way we were before it all went haywire. On the computer screen, Evans pulled up another photo. It was Gigi again, but in this shot, there were no dark circles, none of the sallow skin or drooping lids. Her teeth were straight and her face was broad and glowing. She was nasal breathing again and no longer snored. Her allergies and other respiratory problems had all disappeared. The photograph was taken 2 years after the first, and Gigi looked transformed. The same thing happened to other patients, both adults and children, who'd regained the ability to breathe properly. Their slack-jawed and narrowed faces morphed back into a more natural configuration. They saw their blood pressure drop, depression abate, and headaches disappear. Even Harvold's monkeys recovered. After 2 years of forced mouth breathing, he removed the silicone plugs. Slowly, surely, the animals relearned how to breathe through their noses, and slowly, surely, their faces and airways remodeled, morphing back into their wide and natural state. 6 months after the experiment ended, the monkeys looked like monkeys again, because they were breathing normally again. Back in my bedroom, staring out at the shadow play of branches in the window, I'm hoping that I too can reverse whatever damage I've done in the last 10 days and the past 4 decades. I'm hoping I can relearn to breathe the way my ancestors breathe. I suppose I'll see soon enough. Tomorrow morning, the plugs come out.